Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of Sci Frights, the film discussion podcast at the Interzone where horror meets science fiction. I am Liam Dunn. I am a screenwriter, film critic, and lifelong science fiction fan.
My name is Dr. Lindsay Hallam. I am the course leader in the Film and Screen Studies degree at the University of the Arts, London, and I'm an author and academic who specializes in horror cinema.
Today we are doing another of our Sci-Frights Bites, where we do a shorter edition of the podcast to talk about current releases or re-releases, whatever the case may be. And today we are talking about the horror film that everyone else is talking about, Zach Cregger's Weapons.
Now this was, you've been saying pretty much all year that this is your most anticipated film of the year.
Yeah, and it actually had a really good marketing campaign. It worked on me because I loved Barbarian, Zach Cregger's previous film, which we saw at Fright Fest and just came out like a bolt from the blue, like, what the hell is this? And I thought, well, I can't wait to see what Zach Cregger does next. And this just seemed like a bit of a step up. He's kind of taking his formula and expanding out a little bit. And I must say, it all worked on me and I saw it and I wasn't disappointed. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, because I was even a bit worried. I'm like, oh my God, you're so hyped.
I know, me
too. How is this going to live up? And then as soon as the film finished, I think you pretty much just turned to me and were like, fuck yeah, that rules. So yeah. I knew immediately that you were, and I could tell even before then, later on we'll get into spoiler territories, but towards the end of the film, as things really amped up, you were laughing maniacally. And we'll get to that a bit later on. So you were very enthusiastic about the film. I loved the film, but at first, and there's, again, spoilers later on, there was something about it that slightly stuck in my craw a little bit. But then the more I think about it, the more I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
The more I think about it, the more I'm really liking the film. So it's actually something that's growing on me. I definitely, was looking forward to the film. It was reminding me a lot of Long Legs that came out around this time last year, where there was such a huge hype. And I remember for Long Legs, we went and saw like the first screening on the Friday at like 12 p.m. at Prince Charles Cinema. It was packed. And the anticipation there was just, really kind of crackling off the walls. This we saw kind of a later afternoon, and it was a lot less people there, and it was certainly different to how we saw it at Barbarian at Fright Fest. And in fact, there was a guy in the audience who was there by himself who at one point started snoring very loudly, which I don't think had anything to do with the film, because I don't
know.
He must have been tired.
And I think there was another couple in there who woke him up. And then afterwards he was like saying, thanks for waking me up, guys.
But I don't think that was anything to do with the film. So in terms of the making of the film, it definitely was a step up from Barbarian. So I found out that Barbarian had a budget of $4 million and this had a budget of $40 million. Mm. And there was that huge bidding war. That happened. And was it something about with Jordan Peele that Monkey Paw Productions really, really wanted the script?
And they lost to Warner Brothers, I think, or whoever. Mm. And apparently the story goes that Jordan Peele fired his management company because they failed to make the deal to get hold of Weapons. So I think the script was going around and it was like just setting everybody's, setting everybody on fire with its insanity. Originally as well, it was, I think Pedro Pascal and Renate Rencive, I don't know how to pronounce her name, sorry, were originally cast with a few other people, and then the writer's strike forced them to recast everybody. So Julia Garner, Josh Brolin, Alden Ehrenreich, these were all actors who came in sort of at the last minute, really, to get this film up onto its feet. It's fantastic. And it obviously was like very sought after.
That's
true.
So we should just quickly, I guess, recount the premise of the film, which is that at 2:17 a.m., so in the middle of the night, all students of this one, I think, what are they, third grade?
Yeah.
I don't know. Class, except for one student, all got up out of their beds and ran out into the night, and some of the like ring cam footage and things that were capturing the children running away had them also running with this strange pose.
Their arms outstretched.
Yeah. Yes, which I believe Zach Cregger just said, it doesn't really mean anything. It just looks really creepy. Yeah. And it does look really creepy. And so it's all about the aftermath of that and about this town, this community that is reeling from, you know, all these children going missing. There doesn't seem to be any answers. The police investigation hasn't uncovered anything. So we start off following the teacher of the class, Justine, played by Julia Garner. Who pretty much the town, because there's just no clue as to what's happened to the children, the only thing is that they were all in her classroom. And so everyone's pretty much pointing the finger at her, and she's become the scapegoat. And one of the main people kind of pointing the finger is this father of one of the kids, Archer, played by Josh Brolin. And so the film itself is structured in a really, really interesting way. It doesn't have a huge kind of swings and shifts like Barbarian, but it does seem to be divided into very kind of distinct sections or chapters. So do you want to talk a bit more about the structure of the film or the influence that kind of one of the main influences that Zach Cregger has cited?
Well, I think he said in interviews, which I did look up before we saw the film, he does mention Magnolia, which is one of my favorite films by Paul Thomas Anderson, and it really feels like that's a big influence on it, because the film looks at the events after these kids disappear through the different points of view of characters within the film, and the film kind of will go through, show you one character, and then it'll stop and go back to the beginning of the film to show you another character and the way that they interact and the way that they're affected by this story. It's quite an unconventional structure in that regard. He's also mentioned, I think, a Pulp Fiction as well, but I think like Barbarian, it's a film of layers where he presents sort of this parts of the whole that seem separate from each other, or, you know, so you don't quite see it at the broader picture at first. You're seeing all these bits and pieces, and it's kind of crazy and chaotic. I wrote a staggering parade of grotesque chaos that just seems to be unraveling around these characters as the story progresses. But then you suddenly, there's a big shocking moment, and then it will cut to another character, and then you'll be following them until you get to another shocking moment where in each turn, you're just like, oh no, what's going to happen next?
It's structured really well, yeah. And like it gets you to, yeah, there is this, like you say, shocking thing. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're moving. So again, he seems very good at the structure and the, I guess almost the cliffhanger, and then going, nope, I'm not going to give you, I'm not going to tell you exactly what's happening next. You're going to go over here for a bit.
Yeah.
But then also it kind of filling in the picture. So how did we get to that point that we just saw?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the film does stick to traditional story beats. It just does it in a way that you're not expecting. It does reveal information when it needs to be revealed. And the cliffhangers are ways to keep you on the hook throughout the story. Because otherwise, if you're following one character and then you cut and you're following a completely different character, you could almost like you could risk boring the audience. You can risk just like having them be frustrated and fed up. But the way in which it works, they all kind of intertwine with each other towards the conclusion, which once you see what the actual bigger picture is, and I'm not saying this as a criticism, but the actual plot is quite simple. It's not complicated at all. It's just the way it's presented to you from the get-go that from the outside looking in, it looks completely chaotic and insane. I mean, it is like a crazy plot still, but it's not as complicated as it first appears.
And I think the fact that it took Magnolia as kind of a jumping off point, I think Zach Cregger has even said that he kind of pushed it, was like, it's a Magnolia but horror. He was kind of unabashed in like pushing that as kind of a a tag to draw people in. I think it was also, yeah, Magnolia meets Hereditary. There's definitely some nods in terms of like the characters. Like there's Alden Ehrenreich's character, kind of a sad policeman with a mustache, which is obviously a nod to John C. Reilly. What are some other kind of Magnolia bits that you noticed?
I think there's also that idea of like the characters who first present themselves in a certain way, and then as you dig deeper into the story, it's revealed that they're actually that they're all just people, and we're all just people at the end of the day. And we might present as in a certain way, but then underneath we're different than that, you know. And that they, and I mean, apart from I guess the big villain of the movie, everybody sort of has a moment of grace or redemption or what have you that makes you go, oh, these are just people at the end of the day, even if they're... So, like, Josh Brolin's character is immediately targeting Julia Garner because he's just scared and frustrated and doesn't understand what's happened to his son. And he's just like, well, it's all her class, so she must have something to do with it. There's a whole bit where he goes on his own investigation because he's frustrated the police aren't doing enough. But then at a certain point when the stories start to dovetail, you realise that he's not a hateful person, he's just scared. And you know, we do stupid things, or we do things that might be against our natures normally when we're feeling scared or confronted. So I think there's that, where it's like the peeling back of the layers of the story and of the characters as you delve deeper, and you see and also the connections between all the characters as you go through further. And also in Magnolia, there's like the raining frogs scene, which is kind of what unites all the characters. But instead of that happening at the end, it's like it's the disappearing of the children at the start that is kind of bringing all these characters into each other's orbit.
And I think one of the other I don't know if it is of influence. I haven't heard like Kroger talk about it, but to me, the kind of the structure of the film and the unfolding of the narrative, it reminds me of Hitchcock. So each section where we're following a character, and each chapter is there's a title with a character's name. So you're following things, and the camera work is very much setting it like each section up. Each section is this very subjective experience of what is going on. But yet we as audience members, as we go through, we are learning all the different perspectives. So we know a lot more than the characters. And so Hitchcock always said that the audience should know more than the characters, and that the whole thing about suspense, that, you know, it's the bomb under the table. You got to keep cutting to that. So even though the characters are oblivious, the audience there, and that's what's driving the suspense.
Yeah.
So we are piecing it together, and we are learning more, and so we know more than the characters. So there is that, definitely that tension, that once you start to realize what's going on, you're like, oh, they need to find out. Particularly because you have the one child who doesn't disappear is Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In particular, for me, it was like, as you feel more, it was like definitely feeling like I wanted everyone else to solve what was going on, because at the center of it all is this child.
Yeah. And that's why I think the actual story structure is, there's nothing actually challenging. It's presented in a challenging way, challenging the audience to go along with the ride. But it is around like the midpoint where you start to realize like really what's happening. Because that, again, that's keeping us ahead of the characters. Because I think a film like this, if you keep the audience in the dark too long, or like right up until the end, you're going to get people leaving and just being saying, well, you know, fuck this movie, it's too frustrating, I don't understand what's going on. So he cleverly understands that and he starts to present, and he gives you clues throughout, which, because, you know, you're with the characters for a while not understanding what's happening, but then he begins to place everything in front of you, so you start to get ahead of the characters. And I think with a film like this, that's the smart play, because otherwise there'd just be too much going on and you'd be too annoyed with everything.
I'm confused.
But the Hitchcockian thing is interesting, because I think some people might say that the film is, because, you know, Hitchcock is known that, you know, he kind of has characters that are in service of a plot, right, of the suspense and the tension of the story. And I think that's what happens here. And some people might say, well, these characters don't really feel like real people. They're not like fleshed out enough. But I think the main characters are kind of just representational of figures within society. You have a teacher, you have a builder who's also the father, a policeman, you have a criminal, the character of James, and there's a child, there's Alex. And it seems like when these events that are happening that are kind of larger than them, it kind of, you know, makes them seem like they're cogs in this greater machine. And it's like, it's Kreger playing God with all of these and moving all these pieces around. So it's kind of this director as God kind of moment, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you also run the risk of when you start to provide the answers, that being a bit disappointing. Yeah. And I have read some reviews where they're like, oh, it's all good up and it is scary up until, you know, the reveal. One of the things that I actually quite appreciate about the film, the more I think about it, was that it's different to a lot of horror films at the moment where it is about trauma, although it is, you know, a theme that it is, you know, the story is just a reflection. I mean, I love The Substance. It was probably one of my favorite film of last year. But the whole thing about The Substance was that it really was a sledgehammer with what it was trying to say and the message of the film. Zach Kreger has talked about that, you know, it isn't a political film. Although I did have, you know, some political readings of it that we'll get to later. I am a big proponent of a film isn't just what the filmmaker says it is, that once the film goes out there, yeah, we can bring ourselves and our other interpretations and experiences to it. But yet the film does work really well as just a really fun,
yeah,
crazy ride. But yet also there are these elements in the film, just the fact that it is about child abduction. It is about grief in a sense. And I believe that, you know, Zach Kreger, he started writing this film while he was editing Barbarian, and he lost a really close friend of his, Trevor Moore, who he was in The Whitest Kids You Know, which was a comedy troupe that used to do a lot of sketches that were, they did have a show.
Yeah,
they had a TV show, but I remember watching a lot of their stuff on YouTube. Actually makes me also think of the Philippou brothers, who will come from doing YouTube videos. It's just interesting, these comedy and horror, which we can talk a bit about. But anyway, he was grieving the loss of his friend. So the film, writing the film, I think, was maybe possibly a distraction or just a way to kind of work through that. So you do have this underlying element, I think, of grief, but in particular, the fact that it's a child abduction. And so that whole thing, like, it is really the worst thing, not just to lose a child, but to have no answers is just the worst thing. So, you know, it does set up a mystery. And I know that Prisoners, Denis Villeneuve's movie, was another big influence. So you have there's real stakes, I guess, to it all, that, you know, we do want to find out what's happened to these children. And also made me think of, again, citing another film. We saw another film that came out this year was David Cronenberg's The Shrouds. And in that, that's also about grief. And there's also in that two of the main characters sliding into conspiracy theories. Yeah. And I was reading an interview with David Cronenberg, and he was saying, you know, when something happens, when you lose someone that just means so much to you, there is that trap that you can go down of, like, it must have been the doctors, or it must have been this, or it must have been that, like, that you can easily slide into conspiracy just to try and make sense of it all. So, you know, the fact that all the townspeople and especially Josh Brolin's character, that he's going on his own investigation. Mm-hmm. He just wants to find answers. So So in that sense, it is, yeah, just a really great mystery as well. And that, yeah, you're trying to put the pieces together as well. And there was different theories that I had as I was going through, like, oh, it's this, oh, it's this. Even though it sounds like it's a film about child abduction, how can that be fun? But yet it also manages to do that.
Well, and I think that's his background in sketch comedy is what makes him such a strong writer and director, is that Barbarian and Weapons are both, they have this yes and quality to it, like that these hat on a hat, where he can come up with these scenarios and go, okay, what's next, and then it leads into another thing that's even crazier or something that you zigs when it should have zagged, and it's quite unexpected. And I think he's very good at keeping us, the audience, on their toes, presenting us with something that we might think is a trope. Like, I think there's quite a few horror tropes that he undercuts here, uses a lot, and then twists them in new ways. So things that we've come to expect, he will then turn into an unexpected thing, which is why I think he's really interesting filmmaker, and why this film is one of my favorites of the year so far.
Yeah, and there is some real comedy in the film as well. I think in particular of the character of James, played by Austin Abrams, who I'd only seen before, because as I was watching the film, I was like, I know that guy. And it turns out he was in Euphoria in a somewhat small role, and he was also kind of the shitty guy in the film Do Revenge, the Netflix film that came out a couple of years ago. And he really stood out to me, and it's because he is, you know, there is some definite like humor. So he is this homeless drug addict. Again, it sounds really like not funny at all, or not, you know, yeah, really serious. And he just manages to stumble across some things, but he starts off having this run-in with Paul, the cop played by Alden Ehrenreich, which leads Paul to say, look, you just need to get out of here. But yet, as he's trying to get away, he figures out what's going on. I think he actually was a standout for me.
Yeah, he was great. I need some money to get the job to give you the money.
Yeah.
he was great.
So I guess as alongside the comedy, there's the scares. So we talk about, like, was this scary?
Yes. And I think it had its some requisite jump scares, but it also had just this creeping dread about the whole thing, and just the confusion when things happen. So things that happen before you know why they're happening, just very unsettling, very paranoid feeling. There's some really great dream sequences that are used to build a lot of tension.
Because sometimes I'm like, oh, dream sequences, really? But this film manages to do them very well. Yeah. They all do lead up to this appearance of this strange figure that we soon later meet. There were more, I think, two occasions with two of the dreams where I just was like, oh Jesus. So yeah, they worked really well. But also alongside that, there are these visceral chases and straight up fights that happen. There's a couple, I mean, there's one towards the end, which is incredible. But there's also another one, and yeah, I'm just going to say, yeah, vegetable peelers as well. God. And I think the use of the suburban location is done quite well. And I go, I always do connections to Lynch. I can't help it. But there is the whole thing of like, what is there something lying underneath the surface, or also the fact that the threat and the fear emanating from within the home and within families, that's also just something that comes up a lot in horror in general as well. But Lynch was always the king of that. I think also this camera work. So I looked up the DP is Larkin Siepel, who did Everything Everywhere All at Once. And an interesting, surprising influence that Zach Cregger has mentioned in interviews is the film Son of Saul, which is a film set in a concentration camp following this Jewish man who's imprisoned there. And a lot of it is following behind him and following him, the whole idea of this subjective experience through the camera work. So there's a lot of point of view shots and a lot of over the shoulder. And the way that changes is as you move from one character's perspective to the other, you're over their shoulder. And sometimes you're seeing things play out that you've seen before, but in a different way, from a different perspective. So I think that definitely, the camera work to me really stood out.
Did we get to the spoilers?
Yeah. So,
spoiler zone, everybody.
Yes. We're going to move into spoiler territory. So I guess we need to talk about the big bad of the film, played by someone I did not realize was in the film and was a huge surprise, which is Amy Madigan, who I mostly know from the film Uncle Buck. And so she's shown up in kind of character roles all through the past few decades. So let's talk about Aunt Gladys. Who is Aunt Gladys?
Well, Aunt Gladys, she does show up somewhere around the halfway point in full flesh. The dream sequences we mentioned before, obviously they point towards her with certain things happening within the dreams.
Yeah, you just see these visions of like, it's like very clownish makeup and like red hair.
Yeah, and it's almost like a Pennywise the Clown kind of get up almost. And so then Gladys appears at the office of the principal of the school, played by Benedict Wong, who she says she's representing the parents of Alex, the only boy to survive the disappearances. And we then learn through a section of the film where we follow Alex that Aunt Gladys is actually a witch. And she has she's moved into the family home, Alex's family home, and is conducting her evil black magic. And the reason the children have all disappeared is that she is using them for some kind of ritual, which I think is she wants to regain her youth. So Gladys becomes this, like Pennywise, Freddy Krueger type character figure that keeps appearing to all the main characters in certain ways. And we come to realize that she is the central force that is causing all of this havoc in this town. And what's interesting is that Josh Brolin's character is also triangulating where the kids have run off to and trying to solve the mystery along with Julia Garner. But before he does that, he actually paints the word witch on the side of Julia Garner's car. So the film is kind of playing with that idea of, where you scapegoating people for things that are happening when the actual real perpetrators are going unnoticed.
Yeah, so this was, as I was watching the film, I did have a moment where I was like, oh, okay, so the cause of all these problems and the main figure of evil is this grotesque older woman. And I was just like, oh, okay, we're doing this again, are we? And so that did kind of get to me a little bit as I realized it there. But then the more I think about it, I guess part of my problem was that it was, I've talked about this before, this whole thing of like the monstrous feminine, that it is that women, but especially like aging women, there's a bit of like high exploitation here, that she is so grotesque. And you see that she's actually part of what she's doing as the magic that she's doing is that she must be ill or she's dying. And it's a lot of like, with witch things of poking her finger and like blood and fluids and wrapping hair and things. So it's all this like, linking femininity, especially, and this always thing of aging femininity being disgusting. So that bothered me at first because I thought, okay, we're doing this, are we? But yet, the more I think about it, it started to kind of have this kind of fairy tale-ish element to me. And I kept thinking of Hansel and Gretel for some reason, but I guess it's Hansel and Gretel in reverse and that she comes into the home. So she's this aunt and Alex's parents are like, oh, well, she's got no one. We're going to take her in. So they actually have these really good intentions and she's basically has the parents under a spell. So they're almost like zombified, just sitting there. And poor Alex has to keep going to school. And there's one point where Gladys makes the parents like start
stabbing themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of poking and things. And there's the earlier scene with
James and Paul.
Yeah, where he gets pricked by a needle.
Yeah, a lot of faces.
And again, the pricking of the fingers, isn't that Sleeping Beauty? So there's this interesting. So as I think about it, there's this whole like fairy tale elements to it, which is kind of clashing because it starts off with this mystery. And it does seem very much about, you know, you could say, you know, it's almost evoking something like that happens like after mass shootings of a community reeling and trying to make sense of it all and not knowing who to blame. And then you have this strange witch that comes in. So I do understand that possibly people, when they're watching it, that when you do find out who it is, that it might be just seem like a bit silly or a bit disappointing. It almost makes it this kind of strange modern fairy tale as well. And you have the child in peril, like poor Alex, poor little Alex. It's just the whole thing where he is, where she keeps saying to him, like, you don't know what I can do, like what I can make your parents do. She doesn't threaten him ever. She threatens his parents. And so he has to keep going to school, and it just
feeding them soup from cans.
Oh God, yeah. And this poor little kid. So it's really awful.
But, you know, he gets his in the end because I mean, and that's what the thing. The ending of this film is like so bonkers. That's why I was laughing. You said I was laughing a lot in the movie. That's the most I laughed is at the end because the thing is that Gladys is threatening Alex with all this stuff, but she's showing him how to do the spells. She doesn't even think that she's, you know, because little kids sit and they absorb all this information all the time, and they like he's cottoning on to how this all works. So, and you know, she's used the spell to capture all these children in the basement, and then he uses that magic against her by breaking the spell, like by literally breaking the branch. And then these kids just start gunning for Gladys and attacking her. And it's kind of this great release for everybody and for the audience, because you're just so wound up by that point. And it's like, and you want this Gladys to get hers. And
it's just this crazy chase through all these.
And it just keeps going.
And again, it's going through different houses. So it's this whole thing of like going through the home and just this chaos just bursting through and then coming out again. And it's just something we were talking afterwards. There's just something about the sight of like, I don't know, a crowd of children or, we also mentioned there was an episode of Barry where someone gets chased by dogs. Mm. It's just something about this one person and these like little creatures, whether they be human or dogs or something. Yeah. There's just something about that that just is inherently funny. but yeah, we should talk about the fact that, so why is the film called Weapons?
I think the point being made is it's all about kind of weaponizing people against each other, weaponizing children. And I think that the thing is that because it's children who are the victims or the ones who get disappeared. And whenever children are involved, people's like rationality just goes right out the window. Like, because it's the one thing that as a society we feel that we need to protect, right? So when we feel that we failed to protect children, we start to go completely nuts and start blaming each other and fighting against each other. And that's why, you know, Josh Brolin goes after Julia Garner and paints a witch on her car, because we try to find somebody to blame other than ourselves. And I think even though Gladys isn't doing that specifically, like she's doing it for her own purposes, the fact that like the kids become, like they get weaponized and then she's weaponizing people against each other by like this. She puts a spell on Benedict Wong and he has to go.
Oh God. We need to talk about that. One of the chapters ends with Paul, the principal, just coming out of nowhere and just setting on Justine. And then we cut to like what led up to this. And it's
Yeah.
Again, it's really...
Because we see him and his husband in their home life, and it's this domestic bliss, and then Gladys comes in.
They're like Mickey Mouse t-shirts, matching Mickey Mouse t-shirts, and they're sitting down and, yeah. And they've got like a whole, like his husband's made a whole, like they've got hot dogs and all this stuff.
Yeah. Sitting down and watch TV, and they're watching a thing about parasites, and then Julia Garner's teaching the kids about parasites. So there's this, and there's also this underlying thing of that Gladys is this parasite that's like invaded the domestic bliss of this neighborhood,
and it's just feeding,
feeding off everything, feeding off our hate, our fear, our paranoia, feeding off our the children, off their youth, and that. But what's happened is that no one sees that bigger picture, so they all start blaming each other. And I just confused and don't understand what's happening until when Josh Brolin and Julia Garner finally actually put their differences aside and go, well, you know, wait a minute, let's team up. They actually figure it out, as crazy as it is in the end.
I do feel like you can say that there is some political element, or at least I was thinking of this, that it was very much about this whole idea of the older generation weaponizing the young, or that you have people being manipulated, that there are these malevolent forces, though these bad actors that are manipulating people to turn against each other as a way for them to, I guess, drain from us. And this whole thing of people blaming each other rather than working together. People should be uniting against the common enemy rather than turning on each other. And I thought the fact that, you know, you have this older person with this kind of really bad red hair.
Bad makeup.
You can.
Just turning everybody.
I'm sure Zach Cregger would hate us saying this, but I couldn't help. I mean, maybe this is just me being a wanky academic,
but I think he believes in people, but he also knows how easy it is for people to just be manipulated. Benjamin Lee in The Guardian, who was, you know, had a lot of mixed things to say, wasn't all that impressed with the film really, but he says that, The labyrinthine plot relies on staggeringly incompetent police and willfully ignorant citizens. And it's like, I think on purpose, right? But I think he's saying that you can't, the police being incompetent is that, you know, we live in a time where we don't feel like we can trust authority figures and trust them to do what's right, or feel empowered to convince our neighbors that they're being led on a leash by those in power or by social media or whatever. And I think that's telling of our times. Even if he feels like he's not deliberately doing that, I think just the times that the film is made in, this all leaches in and leaches out, and it's unavoidable. And I think those comparisons are there.
I just think that there is definitely the big trend in horror the past few years has been demonic forces, possession. It seems to be coming up again and again in so many different forms. People being controlled, people being possessed. I mean, the most recent film that we saw before this was Bring Her Back by the Philippi Brothers, Australian film. And in that you have this woman who, you know, is doing awful things to children. Although I think in Bring Her Back, there was, there's some nuance to the woman in that, whereas Gladys is just like pure evil. I mean, Long Legs, which we mentioned before, I was feeling a lot of Long Legs energy.
I prefer Weapons to Long Legs. I think Weapons succeeds a lot better than Long Legs does. But yeah, there is big comparisons.
Yeah. And in that, there are these murders that are happening. But I think Long Legs doesn't give you all the answers.
No.
Whereas this gives you, well, it's Gladys.
But also I think Long Legs shifts because you've got Nicolas Cage in that film and Amy Madigan in this one. But I think Long Legs actually shifts the blame away from the mysterious figure who should be like the boogeyman and more towards the home and the people that you're living with and living next door. They're the ones that are actually should be kept a closer eye on, not these big figures that are trying to scare, you know, that are on the face of it scaring you. But I think Weapons is more on the other way.
Yeah.
Where it is these malevolent forces that are, or these grander forces around us that are manipulating us at home.
Yeah. It seems to be getting better as the year progresses. Sinners is still my favorite so far, but
oh yeah,
but yeah, hopefully there will be a lot more films coming out, horror films coming out, and sci-fi.
And, yeah, and more sci-fi bites.
Yes, yes. So please give us a review. Tell people about the podcast. Yeah. Follow us on social media, on Instagram and Facebook and Blue Sky. You can contact us at scifrightspodcast@gmail.com and let us know what you think of Weapons. All right.
Bye-bye.